First, the bad news. Box office grosses for Transformers Age of Extinction dropped 63% in the film's second weekend. Now the good news. We declined to review Michael Bay's latest project on Movies 101. Hey, dodged a bullet there. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101, and on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I are going to continue the dodge. We're going to discuss three movies, documentaries to be exact, that we saw on our respective on-demand services. So don't touch that dial, because a home-oriented Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.
Hi, this is Movies 101 host Dan Webster with a special message. Spokane Public Radio will be switching to a new website. The web address won't change, so you'll be able to find the site as you always have. But those of you who are listening to the podcast of Movies 101 via feed subscription or through iTunes will need to take active steps to ensure continued delivery of the show to your device. You'll need to go to the Movies 101 page on the new website and resubscribe to the Movies 101 podcast feed. So, if the Movies 101 podcast is not coming to you anymore, you can fix this by going to the new Movies 101 page at SpokanePublicRadio.org and resubscribing to the feed through the appropriate link provided. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and staff writer for the Spokesman Review.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that loves movie theaters but dislikes crowds. Isn't that ironic? Anyway, we avoided theaters over July 4th weekend, as did apparently many moviegoers, this being the lowest grossing July 4th in some 15 years. Instead, we chose to check out three documentaries that we accessed in the comfort of our homes through our respective on-demand services. The first is Life Itself, Steve James's adaptation of film critic Roger Ebert's memoir. The second is The Case Against Eight, a look at the battle over gay marriage in California. And finally, we'll discuss Whitey, United States versus James J. Bulger, a look at the legal quandaries involving law enforcement and one of Boston's most notorious criminals. Let's begin with a look at the guy from Chicago who became America's most recognizable film critic. If Pauline Kael made the world take film criticism seriously through her New Yorker reviews, then Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel brought that sense of seriousness into our living rooms with their public television show, Sneak Previews. Fueled by their competitive natures and a genuine antipathy, at least in the early years, the show, which later was syndicated, became the most popular film review program to date. In his documentary film Life Itself, which he modeled after Ebert's 2011 memoir of the same name, filmmaker Steve James explores Ebert's backstory. Bookended by Ebert's fight with the cancer that would kill him in 2013, James tells of Ebert's childhood, of his obsession with journalism, how he became at age 24 the youngest film critic for a major newspaper, and how he was the first film critic to win a Pulitzer Prize. James features the Sneak Previews years almost as much as he does Ebert's marriage at age 50 to the woman who would help him mature into a loving husband, adored stepfather, and generous friend. As such, Life Itself is more than a look at a celebrity critic's life. It's a look at how this one man bravely faces the end of it. What did you think, Nathan?
Well, I don't think I can readily recall a documentary about such a famous cultural figure that is so nakedly emotional and is really the definition of warts and all. I mean, there's stuff that we see and learn about in Life Itself that is both shocking and hard to watch in a lot of cases, especially the material involving Ebert's seemingly endless hospital stay. We see a lot of stuff in that hospital room that most documentary subjects probably would have said, hey, can you get the cameras out of the room? But Ebert wanted them closer. He knew what made a good movie, and I think that he was possibly directing this as much as Steve James did. And James, of course, I mean, his most famous film is Hoop Dreams, which came to prominence because of Siskel and Ebert. They were the guys that told a lot of people who wouldn't have heard of it otherwise that they had to check out this documentary. And so James owes a lot of his career to Ebert. And this is almost a tribute to him as, you know, a late thank you 20, 25 years later for that boost in his career. And I know that it's probably not surprising that film critics love A Portrait of a Film Critic. But as you said, Dan, this is a lot more than just a standard biography. But as a biography, it's fascinating. One of the best film biographies I've seen in a long, long time. And I've seen Life itself twice now. And it's really an emotional experience. I mean, this, you're not really expecting it, but I cried watching this movie and had nothing to do with the movie stuff. I mean, this Ebert is very, very important to me, and deeply influential to me and what I do, but it's the stuff involving his wife, Chaz, who's, you know, this amazing, courageous woman, and his relationship with Gene Siskel, which we see all sides of, the fact that they hated each other, but they deeply respected each other. And as they got older and as they both suffered their respective illnesses, they found a new kind of respect for one another that was really touching. So I think this is a great documentary, and I really hope people see it when it comes to the Magic Lantern on July 18th.
But I think it's fair to say that this was challenging to watch.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think Steve James planned to film this before Ebert's condition worsened.
Right, and there's discussions in the film about how he's going to be coming out of rehab soon. I mean, they expect him to make a full recovery, which he never does.
Right, and so I do think that it's difficult to watch, and maybe for an older audience or people who've dealt with this in their own lives or in the lives of their families. I mean, that was, as you said, unexpected in terms of the rawness at which we see the whole rehab and hospital stay process.
But you know what? That's also part of the richness of this film also, because it isn't just simply a movie about a guy's dying. It's about a guy who's dying, but who refuses to give up on life as he does so. So in that sense, I think Life itself is a rich film because it forces us to face the fact that we are all going to die one day, and it might not be pretty.
I understand that. And so I did like the parts, particularly about Roger Ebert and his wife, Chaz, who clearly is his anchor, is his, you know, reason for being. And she is an African-American civil rights lawyer who was very much an activist. And when we meet her and knowing what we think we know about him, it's almost impossible,
right,
to see
yes.
the attraction between them. But clearly this is a love story. I guess the thing that I liked the most is, how do you make a film about somebody who was, in essence, a writer? How do you make that compelling?
And because I think writing is not a cinematic activity.
No, never.
And I think the two of you can probably appreciate this aspect of it to a greater extent than almost anyone else, because everyone acknowledged his talent in that area in terms of being able to churn out these movie reviews, you know, in quick order. And Roger Ebert in Life itself, I mean, we see him, Nathan, you said warts and all. And so not only did we see him in terms of his physical health, but his way of being in the world was, you know, this figure larger than life, for better or for worse. And I think that we do see that in his early years and sort of how he mellowed out. The thing I think that we really have Roger Ebert to thank is the fact that he was truly a lover of film. But at the same time, he was able, through sneak previews in part and through his own writing, to bridge that gap between, like, sort of literary and cerebral intellectual film criticism.
The film commentary crowd.
Right. And what the average film viewer would understand and appreciate. And his relationship with Siskel, I mean, I think maybe we need more antipathy on this show, you know, to make it pop a little more.
Oh, shut up.
Okay.
Hey, there we go. There's a start.
You talked about Mary Pat, about his life as a writer. And I think that in this sense, this is where James was able to cheat, because Ebert and Siskel were both known ultimately as much for their television work and for their vocal nature, for their abilities, as they were for their writing. And what we have is a lot of people saying, wow, Roger was a great writer. And we know he won the Pulitzer Prize. My hope would be that people would go back and take a look at some of his books, particularly his memoir of his Cannes Film Festival experience, 2 Weeks in the Midday Sun, which is brilliantly written. Early on, he was a terrific writer, but you have to be willing to explore the page.
And another part of life itself that I think is really entertaining, because this movie isn't all downer. I mean, there's a lot of funny, entertaining stuff in this movie. There's the video of Siskel and Ebert sniping back and forth when, you know, they think the camera's off, you know, the outtakes that made the rounds on YouTube. That's in the movie.
Still
and
there.
It's funny. It's so funny. But also all of the stuff involving Ebert's young life, his carousing 20s, and Siskel too. This was the most surprising thing. Siskel was a friend of Hugh Hefner and hung around at the Playboy Mansion, which what?
Yes,
I mean, that goes
that
against
big handlebar mustache.
Yeah, it goes against everything I thought I knew about Gene Siskel. That was fascinating stuff. And Ebert's struggle with alcoholism. There's all this stuff that makes him more than just a writer or a thinker or a television personality. I mean, he was really this figure who loomed so large in all of these people's lives, and just hearing all these different people that have different opinions about him is fascinating. One guy says, you know, Ebert was a nice guy, but he wasn't that
nice.
You know,
exactly.
It doesn't.
Well, and Gene Siskel's wife tells some tales on Roger Ebert in terms of
stealing a cab from her while she was pregnant, you know. And so I like the fact that James, I mean, he does lionize Ebert in the sense that he's making this film about him, but at the same time, he shows parts of his subject that, you know, aren't the most flattering, and I appreciated that about the movie.
So obviously, I mean, the draw for the three of us would be that this guy was a film critic, influential in what we like to do and what our vocation and avocation is. But at the same time, what draws, I think, life itself to the larger film community is the larger story of a person who grows and at age 50 finally becomes a man and a human being.
And, you know, we talked about the fact that he had become this sort of public face of popular film criticism. And then, ironically, he ends up with a cancer that took away his jaw, and he was unable to continue what he had started, you know, and Gene Siskel died prematurely. So we, you know, are dealing with that in the sort of background as well. But then he does return to writing. So that's what he's able to do. And that's when we know that the end is near, because when he can no longer write, when he's no longer able or willing to do that, then we know sort of all is lost in terms of his going forward. It wasn't a worshipful profile, but it was
a respectful one.
Yes, exactly. And it's well worth seeing, but it's tough, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and it's still amazing to me, though, that Ebert, you know, we're saying that he was robbed of his voice, literally, but he was not robbed of his voice in terms of the output that he had. I mean, the sheer amount of material that he was releasing right before he died is staggering. And
no,
I think that
Christopher Hitchens, I mean,
it was
that?
Amazing. I don't know how he did it, but I think that was his lifeblood. And life itself, I think, is a perfect sort of tribute to the man, who I think is really important to the three of us.
And if nothing else, there's two things that I would recommend this movie. One is Werner Herzog is in it, and two, Martin Scorsese cries, which is what caused Nathan to cry.
I just love Marty so much.
And that was life itself. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Whitey, United States versus James J. Bulger, and the case against Eight. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Steve James documentary, Life Itself. We're going to continue our look at films we saw through our respective on-demand services, Whitey, United States versus James J. Bulger, and The Case Against Eight. Let's begin with a guy who was the inspiration for Jack Nicholson's character in Martin Scorsese's film, The Departed. I'm talking, of course, about the Boston mob boss, James Whitey Bulger, the guy whose connections with all levels of law enforcement from local Boston cops to the FBI, kept him out of jail for decades, even as he was running a criminal enterprise that included everything from gambling to extortion to murder for hire. And when the authorities finally did decide to prosecute Bulger, one of his law enforcement pals tipped him off, allowing him to remain free for 16 years before he was caught in 2011 in Los Angeles and returned to Boston for trial. Directed by Joe Berlinger, who with Bruce Sanofsky directed the Paradise Lost trilogy, Whitey, United States versus James J. Bulger, becomes a kind of he said study in which Bulger and his defense attorneys insist that he was not a government informant. Instead, they claim Bulger had government officials on his payroll. Prosecutors, meanwhile, insist that Bulger was an informant, which may be just their way of explaining why he was able to run his crime empire for so long. In the end, it's not clear who is right, but one thing is for sure, Jack Nicholson's portrayal might not be too far off the mark. What did you think, Mary Pat?
Well, I have to say that I was hugely disappointed in this film because, first of all...
As a filmgoer or as a lawyer?
As a person, how about that? I love Joe Berlinger. And going back to Brother's Keeper, which I think is a masterful documentary.
People need to check that out.
Right.
It doesn't get talked about enough.
Yes. Right. I mean, it's from the mid-90s, and it's about a trio of brothers, one of whom has what we perceive to be some sort of intellectual or developmental disability. And there's a homicide, and, you know, it just plays right to Berlinger's strengths. And based on what we saw, at least in a couple of the Paradise Lost films.
Certainly
but
the first
here,
one.
Yeah, here, this is a mess. And I think it's interesting because when he was interviewed, Joe Berlinger said, this is an irresistible story. You know, here's a guy who was, you know, running the criminal underworld for 25 years. I couldn't help but make this film and so forth. But it's all over the place. It doesn't have a point of view, in my opinion. It doesn't really tell us what happened, and maybe we'll never know. But he relies heavily on these different journalists who have their own sort of projects, either in the pipeline or finished or who've been involved in this story, who are Boston insiders. I don't think from an external perspective, and I'm saying this as a film goer, not as a lawyer, I don't think we learned enough about what was going on. We learned too much about stuff that was irrelevant. This needed a major, major edit, in my opinion, to make it the story that it could have, should have, would have been.
And I don't know if you could make a straightforward film about this case because the case is a mess. I thought this movie was fascinating, and I wasn't confused or thrown off by the things that you were, Mary Pat, but I just found it fascinating that the more people we met, we realized how many journalists and attorneys and personalities in this area, their livelihoods are so reliant on James Whitey Bulger. And then even as he's incarcerated, there are all these people who are still making mega bucks off him. Even some of the guys that committed murders for him are making money off of it with their tell-all books. And most of them aren't in prison anymore.
And they're all talking, saying, I ain't an informant. I ain't a rat.
As they're talking on camera.
But as he said that one time when I saw him kill that guy. Yeah,
I thought it was fascinating. And unfortunately, every courtroom movie, and we're going to be talking about another one a little bit later in the show, after Paradise Lost, doesn't have the benefit that Paradise Lost did of having real courtroom footage. That's what made that movie so effective. And for me, Whitey, even though I agree, it definitely needed a trim. I mean, this is a good 20 minutes too long. It has so much fascinating stuff in it. How about the guy who was the husband or the brother of one of the women that Bulger
murdered? The brother of Deborah Plays.
And he disappears and is murdered under mysterious circumstances as the film is being made.
Right.
I mean, I thought this was really, really interesting. The world that Berlinger documents here is thorny and it's complicated, but to me, that's what made it so interesting.
And you know, it's possible that Berlinger went to the big screen too quickly. Maybe he rushed it. He did say there was
this was the pipeline.
This was the quickest turnaround. I think he was trying to get out first with the story. But he has some great stuff. And I wasn't thrown off by the things that bothered Mary Pat. There were so many things in this film. It was like the proverbial cliche Russian dolls, where you keep opening up something new and there's something bizarre there. And it's like it's all right there in front of us. And he throws everybody. He gets really great interviews with the prosecutors. And they're saying, No, wait a minute. He was an informant, but then he talks to these other people, and they're
and
not
love,
back
and
forth.
I love the fact that Bulger says, I'm a murderer, I'm an extortionist.
Oh, yeah.
I dealt drugs, but I never ratted on anyone. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. I didn't take money from nobody. I paid people.
I paid the cops. I mean, as he's revealing this stuff, you're going, oh, my God, this guy.
Yeah.
So maybe my multiple persona was frustrated here.
You couldn't see the forest for the trees.
Right, exactly. That was it. That was it.
Yeah, whatever. That was Whitey, United States versus James J. Bulger. Let's close with the case against Abe. At last count, more than a dozen states had struck down bans on same-sex marriage. The case against Abe, unlike some issue-oriented documentary films, doesn't so much examine the case for or against same-sex marriage as follow the struggle of a group to overturn California's Proposition 8, which in November 2008 had defined marriage as a relationship between a man and a woman. It's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, Proposition 8 proponents had chanted. Given what looks to be free rein to document what turned out to be a 5-year struggle, the filmmakers, Ben Kottner and Ryan White, found a number of good stories. These include the suit's attorneys, including the two men who argued before the Supreme Court both sides of the 2000 presidential election deadlock, and the defendants, two same-sex couples who would have to stand up under media inspection that would bring most people to their knees. No matter what your stand on the issue, the case against Abe is likely to intrigue you with its insider's look at one of the hot legal topics of the day. As a lawyer, Mary Pat, what was your take?
I thought that this was a compelling documentary, and maybe it is because I am a lawyer, because there are a lot of behind-the-scenes sort of discussions and moot court experiences before we see David Boies and Theodore Olson, again, the two opposing attorneys in Bush versus Gore, prepare this case. And so we see a lot of work being done by various activists, by the lawyers, by the individual plaintiffs themselves. And so from a law perspective, I really appreciated seeing this film, because you don't often get to see the sort of backstory in the way that it was presented here. Now, having said all that, I don't know for the viewer who might be less interested in the legal intricacies, I don't know how this plays for them. Was it sufficiently engaging for the two of you in terms of like learning about not only the case, but the individuals and the...
Yeah, I thought so. I thought it was kind of fascinating to see the ins and outs of taking on a case like this and the thousands of pages of documents that they have to brief every day. And just the fact that these two major attorneys on opposing political sides are coming together in this issue just proves that this is an issue that shouldn't be politicized and yet is. And Dan, you said in your intro that no matter what your stand on the issue is, you'll probably find this intriguing. And that might be so, but I don't think anyone that's against gay marriage is even going to bother watching this. No. And that's too bad, because I think that this is, it's a pretty standard film. I mean, it doesn't really make any leaps in terms of a documentary filmmaking, but I think it's very important just for, if no one else, future generations, that this was documented. And, you know, my kids are going to be looking at this movie in 25 years and saying, why was this even an issue? I mean, it is effective, though.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important things about the case against Abe is that how it humanizes lawyers. I mean, you have Ted Olson, who's the guy.
He's
a conservative lawyer, the conservative lawyer of America.
In fact,
and
the
he
LGBT.
Is a compassionate, empathetic person who, who's understanding.
There's an
exactly.
LGBT group that speaks out against the defense, against the people that are against Proposition 8,
because
he's this Republican
and
bigwig.
Yet, what an admirable guy this is.
Yeah.
I mean, this is probably a movie that they should show in law schools. Mary Pat, listen to me. They should be showing in law schools, because it does give a good view.
That's a good point.
It's almost a counterpoint to all those great lawyer jokes out there.
Well, and I think that certainly this is, in the end, a film about relationships. And I think that the lawyers recognized that, you know, all the legal maneuvering could take place, but these plaintiffs, they had to make them reflect the reality of what their lives were like and how important their families were to them. Mm-hmm. And I think they succeeded in doing that, not only in the case, but in this film as well.
Yes. And that was The Case Against Abe. This is Movies 101, and I'm Dan Webster. Earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed life itself and Whitey, United States versus James J. Bulger. Let's take a moment to thank Patrick Clausen for both producing and engineering our show, and let's extend that thanks to you too, our loyal listeners, as we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again brave the world of current cinema. Until then, remember, as Roger Ebert once said, every great film should seem new every time you see it. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. This is Dan Webster. Join Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, special guest Leah Sotelli Preston, and me on August 20th at the Bing Crosby Theater for a special Movies 101 live taping, followed by a screening of Richard Lester's A Hard Day's Night featuring the Beatles. Tickets to the film, which critic Kenneth Turin said creates pure infectious joy, are $10 and are available through the station. For more information, go to SpokanePublicRadio.org.